This podcast is made possible by the generosity of supporting members. Please visit dharmaocean.org to learn more about becoming a supporting member. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. In this episode, we listen to excerpts from talks Reggie has given on the Mahayana stage of the meditative journey. He discusses how we awaken to the vast suffering of the world and respond to the call in our hearts to meet this suffering with love. These excerpts are taken from talks given at a variety of public retreats held in Crestone, Colorado.
And then the second stage on the path is the Mahayana, which, simply put, is a process of decentralizing and emptying out any sense of self, even the self that has given up confirmation and given up judgmentalism. There is, you know, another step, which is we actually need to completely decentralize, and we need to remove the apparent boundary between ourselves and other people so that we actually become them, in a sense. Not in a kind of, New Age sort of vague kind of everything is one type of thing, but more in the sense that we don't resist others. We don't resist them. And even to keep our own spiritual, that we don't try to keep our own personal spiritual space private, that we are actually willing to decentralize and we're willing to allow others to be part of our space. And, of course, that's difficult because we have finally created some space in ourselves and then all of a sudden we need to let go of that, and we need to allow others to inhabit our world with everything that they are and all the difficulties that other people bring to us. And that's actually very necessary for us. It's a very necessary stage. And the Bodhisattva commitment helps us a very great deal. We commit ourselves into that process. And of course, at the beginning of the process, we don't really know whether we can do it. In fact, we suspect we can't. At the same time, we also see that it's important, and we see how much we're holding back and how we have this private little space, and we don't even want to see our meditation instructor because it might disturb our peace of mind and our calm. And we begin to realize that, could be a problem here. Something's fishy. I'm kind of hanging on to it. There comes a point when you see, and you have to see it yourself, you know. Nobody can tell you that you need to move on now, right? I mean, always with the Dharma, you have to, it has to be your inspiration and your sense of your own limitation. But there does come a time when holding on to and protecting oneself in that way, which in the Hinayana is good and important, and in fact, we do have to do that in order to nourish the inner space. We have to. That's very, very important. But at a certain point, we feel ourselves that in order to go deeper, strangely enough, into our own inner space, we actually have to open. So that would be the transition. And again, very important, you'll know when that time comes. We all will know when it comes. And the important point is we can't, you see, this is where we talk about the practicing lineage. In the practicing lineage, you never, ever, ever do anything because somebody tells you to do it, because your teacher tells you to do it, because the books tell you to do it, because everybody in the Sangha is doing it. In the conventional lineage, people do things just because, well, it's the next step. You know, I took my Hinayana. Well, when are you going to take your Bodhisattva vows? Well, you should do it. You know, come on, move along. You got to get on. And then you do the Bodhisattva vows. Well, when are you doing, you know, level 5 of Vajrayana? What about your Nindra? Did you finish that yet? You know, you got to keep going. That kind of mentality you know, it works in a conventional religion, so sort of, and it works in the conventional lineage of the Dharma, but it doesn't work in the practicing lineage because it's not authentic. It's actually fraudulent. So we have to that's the whole point. That's one of the things about the Hinayana. The Hinayana is giving up politics. So if we truly have understood the desire for people to like us and for us to fit into some kind of thing, to go along with the group, to be confirmed by other people, if we really understand that and we've really got a handle on it, not in the sense that it's gone, but that we can work with it, then the practicing lineage approach is protected. And we won't do things simply because other people are doing them or because somebody says you should do it. But in the Mahayana, in order to go further, we need to actually train in letting go of our inner space. And by letting go of the inner space, initially we may feel that we're overwhelmed by the outer situation. But of course, on the Bodhisattva path, the more you work with other people, actually, the more you have to meditate. Because you can't, you know, the minute you start feeling that inner space ebbing away, you need to actually practice more deeply so that you can be with people and that inner space is still there. So it's strange, but what we're doing in the Bodhisattva path is actually we're taking the inner space that we have learned to develop in the Hinayana, and we are learning how to find that not only when we're with ourselves, but also with other people. And it's very, very challenging because other people do push our buttons in all kinds of different ways. And then we practice, you know, so you go out and you get upset and you come back and you practice. You go out and you get irritated and you come back and practice, and you go back and forth, back and forth. And through that process, you begin to realize that space in your mind is actually always there. And even when you're upset, it's there. And even when people are being difficult, it's there. That's a huge discovery. That's known as the Buddha nature, which really begins to become clear in the Mahayana. And you realize it's not a personal thing and it's not separate from others. So that's very helpful. So we have this identity of being a bodhisattva in the Mahayana. And we do a lot of practices. We do Tonglen, and we do the Four Immeasurables, and we work with the Paramitas. And, you know, particularly in the practicing lineage, we are cultivating our own deeper self in such a way that the six Paramitas begin to actually become part of our life. And the Four Immeasurables become part of our life. We don't really particularly need to practice equanimity because equanimity is actually the nature of the mind itself. Loving kindness comes out of the nature of the mind itself. It's something that develops. But then we have the next stage, which is, you could say, further subtlety of the Hinayana, which is letting go of the focus on our own attainment. Because at a certain point, you know, in the beginning of the path, as we've talked about here, you do have to focus on yourself. You really have to develop the tools and the self-knowledge and so on. But at a certain point, that actually starts to get in the way. And then we take the Bodhisattva vow, and there's a sense of letting go. And really what the Mahayana is about is unlocking the human heart. It's not about, again, cultivating an identity or becoming, you know, a Mahayana Buddhist, anything like that. But it's about going through a certain very specific kind of training, you know, just like meditation, which, you know, you spent a lot of time here learning how to meditate, learning sides of it, and seeing how to work with your bodies. In the Mahayana, we go through certain very specific training to unlock our human heart. You know, the heart has its own way. And the heart has its own, you could say, its own mission in the world, and the mission is other people. And we do these practices, the various practices of Mahayana, like Tonglen and the other ones, in order to take the chains off our heart and free our heart so that the natural love that we have in us can begin to unfold. Again, this is a fourth jhana approach. We're not talking about learning certain practices for their own sake. We're talking about learning them in order so that we can free ourselves to love other people. In the fourth jhana, it's said that the natural condition of the human person is to love all beings and to love life. And if we're cut off from that, it's because, as I was saying the other day, it's because of learned behavior. We have learned to retreat from the truth and the reality and the power of our own hearts. So when we take those chains off through the various kinds of practices in the Mahayana, then the heart is freed. And we are freed, frankly, you know, we're freed from having to worry about ourselves anymore, even in a spiritual way. And that freedom actually helps us go much further in terms of unlocking.
We're starting to work with the heart. And I mentioned probably last night, it's hard to keep track anymore, but I mentioned that in the Indian tradition and in the Chinese tradition and basically throughout Southeast Asia and East Asia, the mind is here. The mind is in the heart. And this term citta, which is translated, you know, chit is a Sanskrit root. Chit means to know. And the term citta means it's a substantive and it means mind, or we translate it as mind. But then we have this interesting question of why is it in the heart? Why is the mind in the heart? And I want to say something about that. The a lot of times, you know, when we hear that the citta is in the heart, we think, oh, that's nice. You know, it's not too cerebral and they're putting it here because it, you know, it's like basically the mind is what we think the mind is, but it has this little extra kind of emotional connotation. And isn't it sweet, you know, that they locate it in the heart? And it doesn't really mean much. You know, it's like quaint, a quaint kind of thing. And the fact of the matter is that the heart is a prism, P-R-I-S-M, in which is reflected the totality of our human awareness as it arises in the body. The heart is the place where we come to awareness of what the body knows, the body in its totality. So the interesting point is that this part of our mind, which is, you know, this cerebral left hemisphere, which is analytical, and it's the IQ mind, it's judgmental, it's analytical, it's speculative, it is categorizing things, and that is actually only a very minor and peripheral part of the human intelligence. To know something this way is not to know something. That's very interesting. You know, from the Buddhist point of view, what we do up here is we process in an intellectual way what we know. But what we know is what arises in the heart. So what we are doing when we awaken the heart is we are shifting our allegiance from a more conceptual kind of knowing, which is a second order knowing, to what's called in Buddhism primary order knowing, which is the knowledge of the heart. The knowledge of the heart is, you know, how can I say it? It's much more dark. It's much more total. It's much, you know, you can't pin down the knowledge of the heart. The only things you can pin down are things that you've conceptualized. The knowledge of the heart is ever expanding. It's vast. It's awareness, really, more than it is actual knowledge. And yet it's direct experience of the world as the world is in and of itself. when you are with another person and you let your heart see them, you see how it is for them. You know them. You know their experience, not from the outside, but from the inside. The knowledge of the heart knows how to view things from the inside of what they are, not from the outside. So the heart never objectifies, because objectification isn't, it's not of interest, and it's a paltry, dead kind of knowledge. So when we talk about knowing with the heart, we're talking about a condition of surrender to our own life, and a condition of surrender to the vastness and the subtleties of how the world is. There's no separate self from the point of view of the heart. The heart doesn't know us as being separate individuals that are isolated and cut off. The natural condition of the heart is union. Union means that you see the other and you feel the other, and there's no separation. So I wanted to just mention that that's what we're really developing. There is a teaching in East Asian Buddhism, in Chan tradition, which is the Zen form of, in Chinese Buddhism, called trusting in the heart. Trusting in the heart means trusting in the knowledge that is very shadowy, it's very subtle, it's very somatic, and it's a sense of much more sense of instinct than it is of being able to stand back and look at something. You know, do we trust the momentum of our own life? Do we trust the trust means opening and feeling and tasting everything that goes on around us? You know, we pull back from it, but can we go toward it? What we're doing here is we're learning to actually live in our heart and to see the world and feel the world from the point of view of our heart, and not to get confused by what we think. The only way you can ever be confused is by trusting your thoughts. Isn't that interesting? And sometimes, you know, we think I'm very, very confused. I used to have this really clear picture of reality, and now I'm totally confused. Is anyone feeling that here? Thank you. The clear picture of reality was a clear picture, but it doesn't have anything to do with reality. And one of the interesting things that happens in the Datun is the heart does come to life, whether we like it or not, and we start to feel and know in a direct, non-conceptual way our life. And the discrepancy between what we used to think, because we factored out our actual direct knowledge, and then finding out what it's really like, it can be a bit of a jarring experience. And it does create a dissonance in us for the time being. But then, as I said, you know, we grow into trusting the heart, actually, and not particularly trusting what we think. I mean, it still goes on. We don't really trust it. And then pretty soon, as I said, you know, already, the thinking self kind of gets it that we're not paying that much attention to it. And so what it does is it starts tuning into the heart. And then it becomes a servant of the heart. And then, you know, things are as they should be.
To download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Our music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Kechog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.